Good day, everyone. This is Peter Yim, your host. We have today a joint OOR, Ontolog, NCBO, Creative Commons, IAOA, and OASIS co-organized Open Ontology Repository Intellectual Property Rights Policies and Issues panel discussion. This is the launch session of a mini-series of three sessions, and it's September 9th, year 2010. Today's topic is OOR IPR Session 1, an exposition on relevant IPR regimes. We are honored. I'm going to slide two of the opening deck. We are honored to have as our keynote speaker today Dr. George Strawn, who is the Director of National Coordination Office for the Federal Government's Multi-Agency Networking and Information Technology Research and Development. And the NCO reports to the Office of Science and Technology Policy within the Executive Office of the President of the United States. So in essence, we have the person who set the agenda for IT research and development in this country. Dr. Strawn is on assignment to NCO from the National Science Foundation, where he most recently served as the Chief Information Officer. I don't think George needs further introduction, so I will pass the floor to George, and if people can bring up his slides, all yours, George.
Thank you very much, Peter. I'm very happy to join you all, but you know, and I trust the others will find out quickly enough, I'm an ontology wannabe as opposed to an ontology expert. As such, I offer these remarks as a few framing comments showing my interest and the interest of others in the U.S. government, and then I'll quickly yield the floor to our panel of experts who I think will have much more to say. Slide two, please. Peter told you my connections with the government. I should point out that much of what I say will be my opinions and therefore not necessarily to be confused with official U.S. government policy at this point in time. However, I can say that the administration is clearly in favor of open government, transparency, open access. Congress, of course, has mixed minds on the subject of open access to government-funded research results, which I think is an important topic and will play out over the next year or two as the debate about open access to scientific literature continues. If the open access to scientific literature prevails, then it seems to me that open ontology repositories may have a big job opportunity. And when or if the open access to government-funded scientific data prevails, which I think is more likely to happen more quickly, then open ontology repositories seem to me will also be called for. Many people now are speaking of the fourth mode of science after experiment, theory, and simulation, also known as data-intensive science, and advocates seek to make the scientific record a first-class scientific object, i.e., one where science can be performed as well as recorded. And it seems to me that ontologies and open ontology repositories may play an important part in this this important dimension of the future. Slide three, please. Now, to tell you the truth, I was helping Peter look for a keynote speaker, and he pointed out that a keynote speaker ideally should be a policymaker, an open IPR policy advocate, and have a legal professional background. Well, my office and I gather information for policymakers. I am indeed an advocate of open IPR policies, and I have a number of friends who are lawyers. So that's as close as you get to the ideal in my case. Number four, please. This is just to remind me what your goal is with these series of three sessions over the next several weeks. Exposition of the state of relevant IPR regimes, which will be mostly handled by the panelists, I'm quite confident, in just a few minutes. And I suspect we'll have something to say in this session as well on IPR issues relating to ontologies and ontology repositories. I certainly will ask a question or two, which might be held off until the second session. And then following, you all will have a discussion about what are the best licensing arrangements. Well, this is a nice, coherent agenda, and I look forward to seeing how it turns out. Slide 5, please, can be skipped, as it was simply to remind me that how we were operating today. So let's go directly to slide 6. This is simply my writing down of what I discovered in the literature that the OOR group has been accomplishing up to this point. So I'll simply mention these because I may have a question or two as they go down them. OOR will be an open global collaboration like the Apache project. Well, all right, or is it like a number of projects, since ontologies will probably be independent as well as related to each other, delivering a federated infrastructure of persistent and open registries, repositories, and associated services sounds like a good statement of the goal, where the community will be contributing both tools and content, and the tools will be carry an open source technology license. That's where we're getting down to business today. Content, primarily ontologies, one presumes, will be similarly published under some open content license, and deciding which license is, I think, the primary task of this series of activities. The OOR team will stand up at least one instance of an open ontology repository. And then the interesting question, or the final statement is the most interesting to me, that while OOR technology and content will be open, proprietary ontologies, and I presume that means proprietary ontology repositories, should also be able to connect and interoperate with it. I'll ask in advance, I'm wondering what interoperating between proprietary and open means. Slide 7, please. So apparently you wisely spent a couple years refining that agenda, figuring that once you had down what you were going to do, that this would be the time to look at clarifying the IPR issues relating to ontologies and OORs. Surely you're wise to consider this dimension of things, since intellectual property and other matters seem to be predominant in our increasingly software and digital culture. So just exactly how these relate to the ontology dimension of the world is of course, a very important topic. Slide 8, please. I have several pages of comments and questions to you all, and then I'll be ready to hear from the panelists. As I mentioned before, I'm an advocate of open access and open IPR. I don't suspect it will be the whole of any particular area. Profit-seeking, even occasionally profit-making, is a good motivator for the economical world. So both of these dimensions will have their places, and I expect the places to change over time as technology and other matters advance. Certainly we already see in the case of software that open access, open source software is at the bottom of many stacks of important software products, where value-added proprietary software may exist on top of the common base of open access software. And surely that is a good way to promote a common base from which multiple services and products can be offered in a networked world. Therefore, that makes this a crucial dimension of the networked world, I believe. Open access means a lot to me and my colleagues, and of course I'm focused on the science areas, so it can imply open access to scientific data, can imply open access to scientific literature, and open access to software, scientific and otherwise, and these three dimensions are all important, and it seems to me that they can all relate and all will relate to the world of ontologies as we progress. Speaking of intellectual property, it's of some interest to a non-specialist like me to note that at present, copyright law is used to prevent open access to scientific literature and to support open access to software. And I'm sure the panelists will talk further about Creative Commons and other types of use of copyright that indeed facilitates open access. Data is, to me, the most emergent area, both with respect to IPR matters and other issues. Scientific data does not naturally be shared, does not become shared naturally, both because scientists want to mine their own data before competitive scientists can mine it for them, and also the cost of making scientific data available and somewhat permanent are not yet worked out, at least in the United States, in terms of where those costs will be borne. So both proprietary scientist issues and cost issues relate to do it as well. I know some people would consider ontologies to be a separate discipline and perhaps a separate from computer science. And that may in fact turn out to be the case. But speaking as a computer scientist, I look at ontologies and semantics as something that's been a part of the computer science discipline for some time and something that seems important to the digital age and digital information. And to me, there seem to be relationships between open source software and open source, or shall we say, open ontology repositories. I'll be interested to hear how the discussion goes a little bit later today. Slide 9, please. I guess you know, and the panelists know much better than I, my very general statement is that there appear to be two types of open access intellectual property rules. The first one where any use of your open access stuff must also be labeled as open access and carried forward in the same open access regime. The alternate approach, an alternate approach, is where open access stuff can be taken up either to be open or to be proprietary. I'm not sure. I'd be curious to know if this type of open IPR is different from your statement about open access repositories interoperating with proprietary repositories. I'll also be curious to know whether you end up choosing one type of open IPR or indeed whether different repositories will have different IPR regimes. And finally, please, in slide 10, I'd simply note again up at 30,000 feet that seems like the last 25 years has given us three mini IT revolutions. PCs, which were the revolution of the 80s as we moved from mainframes to personal computers. Although it was begun much earlier, the Internet became a public vehicle for interconnection of computing and information resources in the 90s, and it's now well ensconced as a very important global infrastructure in that regard. But now that we have distributed computing, widely distributed computing, and the ubiquitous Internet, I think we find that the primary use of these wonderful intellectual capabilities is for the information that they contain. And surely, ontologies and all things semantic, as we go forward, will continue to help us turn the data deluge into a data cornucopia. So I wish you all good hunting and good luck in this process. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, George. That's very inspiring. I'm glad you can stay with us. I'm sure there will be questions for George later. Let's hold off and go back to my introductory slides again. So I would like to, just for the sake of people who are unfamiliar with what we're doing, I have a slide for OOR, which I wouldn't go through, but there's a link at the bottom. I'm on slide 3 now on the opening deck. And we are talking about OOR being an initiative for open content, open source software, and open infrastructure. And each of those may have different connotations as far as IPR is concerned, and I'm sure our panelists will let us know soon enough. Going on to slide number 4, I would like to thank our co-organizers, besides the OR initiative, which is the team of people who are actually working to provide the open ontology repository, both software content and infrastructure. We have the Ontolog community, which is the community of practice where this session is hosted. We have NCBO, the U.S. National Center for Biomedical Ontology, who is an integral part of the OOR team and who has so generously donated their BioPortal code base, which formed the code base where the OOR software development could spring from. Actually, I want to say that I'm chairing this session just because Mark Musen, who is supposed to be chaired today, had a sudden conflict that he could not sort of avoid. So I usually work in the background, but I'm really honored to have the chance, partly because we have George with us today, and partly because the 3 open IPR experts that we have invited are among the people I have the highest respect for, being an open advocate myself. So the other co-organizers of this series includes Creative Commons, the International Association for Ontology and its Applications, as well as OASIS, which is the preeminent standards development organization for open standards. So as a team, we hope we could do the job properly. So going on to slide number 5, this is what we are trying to do. We are just trying to start a dialogue among the global ontology community and other stakeholder communities to specifically address IPR issues for OOR as well as for ontologies. And we know this series maybe can help us get some consensus on what we can do immediately for OOR. It definitely will not resolve all the IPR issues in the horizon. And so this will be a quest for which we will just start with this set of virtual sessions. But as a community, we trust we will addressing a very important set of issues that really have to be cleared before the world can realize the full potentials of open ontology repositories enabled by the science and technology of ontology and semantics. Going on to slide 6, Dr. Strawn has already shown people that we have 3 initial sessions to be planned. planned and rolling out. The third one actually has been scheduled for the 30th. I noticed on Dr. Strong's slide here, the 23rd or the 30th, but we definitely will do it on the 30th now. And going on to slide number 7, I am glad to be in a position to say that we are lucky to have assembled some of the top experts on open IPR today to give us an exposition on the IPR landscape and the state of the relevant regimes. With us today are Mr. James Bryce Clark, Jamie Clark as we call him, who is the General Counsel of OASIS, Mr. James Wilbanks, Vice President of Science of Creative Commons, and last but not least, Mr. Bruce Perrins, who is the original author of Open Source Definition. Whenever I use the word open, I have to go back to Bruce's definition. Going on to slide number 8. So what can you do? As a community of practice, please participate and influence the outcome. Join us at these 3 sessions. Be active, because after the experts give us the lay of the land today, we are going to open up the discussion on the Ontolog Forum mailing list. Voice your opinion there, give us suggestions, ideas, and stay active, because I mean this is a long quest. We need to make sure ontology and semantics stay open and accessible. Actually, that has been one of my driving mandates to put time and effort into running Ontolog. So let's make sure these things stay open and accessible. I have on slide number 9 a few links that people can go through where there are more details if they want to. So without further ado, I would like to bring on Jamie Clark, who will give us his thoughts on the OOR IPR issues. Jamie.
Very well. And,
yes, that's great.
Good day, everybody, whatever time of day you're facing. I'm Jamie. Peter will be advancing the slides for me, so let's see if I can provide something of a useful introduction. We are at the first of 3 sessions, as you can see from that helpful diagram. I'm mentioning that because we'll be doing some other things in other sessions, and therefore are spared from doing them today. Next slide, please. 2 biases I want to point out. One is that since we're in the first session, we don't have to solve all those IPR problems today. We're not here to choose a license. We're not here to engage in the deep, interesting parsing of the various IPR regimes applicable in various parts of the globe, and whether they do or do not apply to ontologies. This is the subject of many disciplines, many articles. It's fascinating stuff, and I want to warn you that many of us on the phone here probably would spend the rest of our lives debating that. Given a choice. So, not today's goal. Today's goal is to recognize risks and issues and how to help something virtuous like the OOR navigate through those uncertainties. That's the bias diagram at the lower left of that slide. The bias diagram at the upper right of that slide is simply my own. I'm a lawyer, have been for 27 years. I work professionally for one of the older open standards consortiums. So my interest is primarily in standards, and my interest is primarily in government, industry, and academic cooperation in voluntary standards creation. So I'm sure that brings biases, and that helps explain some of mine. Next slide, please. We're talking about being open, which is a good thing, and you can see there's quite a lot of background work on the wiki for the OOR part of Ontolog, pointers of which are available in Peter's material, about what open means. And we could spend a lot of time on that, which I don't generally propose to spend today. But I do want to say that according to at least one opinion, when we're talking about open, we're talking about how a community or an anticipated community of users and contributors of work into an ontology repository defines its own requirements. What do we need? Well, presumably we need wide availability. If that is our goal, we need to somehow to cope with other things in the world that tend to restrict availability, which includes what are called IPR issues by some, licensing and the like. It includes material that's hosted somewhere that then goes away. It includes material that is hosted somewhere, but in some manner that's not generally available to people who want to use it. From OASIS's point of view, what we have found is that although our patent and copyright licensing practice is an important part of what we do to make sure that the standards our members create continue to be useful and available, it is equally important that we get some practical things right, like where are they, what's the IT plan, who owns them, who can make them go away, in what form are they present, to what degree do we promise to keep them there. And we're going to be talking a little bit about those things in general today because it is us, folks, who are, as people interested in defining and supporting this project, we'll have to decide what open needs to mean for this project, the Open Ontology Repository. Next slide, please. As George actually pointed out, some restrictions may be virtuous, not bad. Even within the OOR discussion over the last couple of years, you will see folks suggest that there may be contributors who want to donate material that can be used in some places but not other places. Perhaps there are export issues and laws. Perhaps there are suitability or language issues. So there may be restrictions for where something is used. There are any number of license practices in the world that attempt to restrict what use can be made, as you know well. There are some restrictions of special kinds that I just want to mention for a moment that are widely thought virtuous. For example, OASIS retains copyright over its standards. We also have a coveted outstanding that says perpetually anybody can use them and derive from them and so forth. So we're not actually trying to use that copyright to stop people from using them. So why, one might ask, do we even bother keeping the copyright? Well, we do that so that if somebody republishes the whole darn thing and says the open document format and changes it, we at least have the right as copyright holder to say, no, the open document format as passed by OASIS and ISO is here. It is this one. It is not that one. And it would actually be in part a copyright action if we ever needed to tell someone that they were incorrect in saying which is the real source or in feigning a derivation to be something that's not. So there's some restrictions, often but not always funded in copyright, that are designed simply to maintain source integrity or citation integrity of work so as to allow folks to know when they're looking at the thing they think they are versus somebody else's knockoff. Next slide, please. So I guess the bumper sticker for that one is some restrictions may be appropriate and virtuous. Here's the next question. Whatever your terms are, how do you enforce them? There are, quote, licenses, close quote, that say, we will give anybody who wants to use this thing a license. But by the way, you have to come talk to us and get a writing and we'll give you a piece of paper. They want to have a physical piece of paper with a written signature. They want to hear who is using it. For all we know, some of those people may be data mining or tracking those uses. Is it openly available? One could argue that it is. Is it easy to use if you have to go talk to the licensing office every time? One might argue that it's not. There are other sorts of license behaviors that simply make a declaration and say, here is what anybody can use. Anybody who falls in the defined class can use. It's a writing, and you can count on it, but you don't have to talk to them about it. And there's a sort of subspecies of that that simply says, you may have some rights in this thing, and if we do, we're not going to exercise them, so put it down. Also, a species of not requiring a writing. Not requiring a writing is an issue, but so is ease of use. if you look at the non-assertion form, which is linked at the bottom of this slide number 5, I do recommend you go look at it this moment. But essentially, it is the form that some companies choose to use of that third alternative, where the persons who have an obligation and who are contributing and participating simply say, okay, if we have any rights, we're not going to raise them, so you don't have to worry about us. However, even that, as the lawyer reason, one of the questions that I think we should be returning to here is, how important is it for us to create rights that are safe to ignore? Whether or not somebody wants to hire a lawyer or an expert to read whatever OOR puts out, puts in its boilerplate, can we reach a condition where at the end of the day, the folks who use it look at it or glance at the legal page of boilerplate somewhere or the statement of rights or the statement of whatever and say, yeah, okay, close enough. I don't have to go and engage an expert to figure out that it's safe to do this. And I believe that in a lot of the regimes, in open standards and open source, essentially the success of those licensing or permission regimes has largely relied on the fact that the boilerplate, which is still long and one might still have to read occasionally, is simple enough and understandable enough that users repose confidence in it and are willing to go along with it even if they don't understand or read it in total. So, for example, someone who says, okay, this has a Creative Commons license, it's probably okay, I can use it, may choose to do so simply by reposing confidence in that community and the large number of users, and may not feel they have to hire a lawyer. So there's the real question, I think, for us in designing OOR. Can we create something that is safe to ignore for most users most of the time? Next slide, please, and I'll take this to slide 6. Now, there's other things going on than legal stuff, licenses, and what's sometimes called IPR. If you want something to be open, you're talking about users and developers relying on its continued availability. They create sunk costs. They start using code lists or lookup tables or systems or formats, and they tool and they train people to use them with the expectation that stuff will continue to be around. So there are issues beyond license. Whoever is the repository or owner or holder or indexer of this material, are they giving an assurance that that stuff will stay around? Are the people who are bringing things to them, the donators of, for example, ontology material or software, assuring somehow that that material will stick around? Who owns it? Who controls it? Can they make it go away? Are they entangled sufficiently with competitive interests and insufficiently heterogeneous so that there's some risk that at some future point controlling parties will change or decide that it is in their strategic interest to make it go away? And finally, there's a host of technical issues, all of which face us in designing an OOR that we can be likely to use. Are we creating something that everyone will be able to use easily? Will the conventional material that is in two forms of text and software and things like that, will it all be using languages, standards, deployment methods that are widely available to people? Will it be platform neutral? Will someone who wants to do the work themselves, rather than hiring consultants to do it, be able to approach material with confidence that they can work their way through the system and make practical use of it? So we have, in addition to a licensing issue, a governance issue, and a set of technical issues to assure safe use and widespread reliance so as to justify the folks who want to put energy into using the stuff we create. Next slide, please. This is all I'm going to say about law, I think, in this slideshow. And I want to tell you this, for a lawyer who spends his time with this, doing one slide out of 14 on law is pretty good. Here's what I'm going to say today. Lots of people think that some aspects of ontologies, however they might be defined, cannot be copyrighted or cannot be patented or can be designed so as to make it difficult to claim possession in them or may be subject to other regimes of law which those of you in the United States may not have even heard of, because we have a variety of laws around intellectual property in the world. So my assertion today is simply that there's a lot of uncertainty there, and that it's unlikely to change radically over the lifetime of the design of the OOR project. So our job should be to design for an uncertain set of rights, to take in things subject to such protections as we can reasonably confect, with such warnings as we can reasonably confect, and use such methods and rules and filters as we can reasonably apply to come up with material that will be widely usable as best as possible, even if we don't know ultimately what some court or regulator is going to do to all those imponderable rules and laws which are evolving. Next slide, please. Here's how OASIS handles this. We are a standards organization. We have members that many, although not all, are commercial. They come in with a variety of interests. They participate as members under policy that puts certain obligations on them. We're going to talk about the life cycle and workflow of that in a minute, but here is the basic idea of how a host organization for material, in our case standards, created by committees that have their own life cycle and then issue final results, that here's what we do with them. We have, first of all, membership. If you are going to a participant or a contributor, you have to be a member subject to certain rules. So there's a traceable acknowledgement from those contributors that they have contributed to those rules. One of the things that those rules do is create an obligation to people who contribute material. One of those things that rule does is it creates an obligation for people who participate on the assumption that if there are folks in the room talking, they, as well as the folks posting code or drafts, are adding their views into the final material, which is an aggregate of the work of the group. Those folks with those contribution and participation obligations are required to make certain disclosures of known interests. There's a limit to how powerful a system that can be, but they are required to, by our rules, tell us if they know something specific in certain ways, which are all listed in that policy. Perhaps more importantly, they're also required to make it available. People who participate in OASIS committees are agreeing by their participation, rather like the ontolog IPR policy, that if they put things into the pot, they will make them available under certain license terms. That's an entry requirement of working in OASIS, and in most standards organizations that are well-designed. In OASIS' case, there's also a project-by-project choice. There are several sets of terms, all of which may have some virtue. Two more elements, and then I'm done. There is an open public feedback license, which I have to say I think is very important, because not everybody who has an opinion is going to be a member of OASIS and go through all that participation and rigmarole. But we still want to know what other people think. So there's a side door or a second venue for pure public participation that nevertheless hands it to us through a mechanism that assents to our reuse of it and that they're giving us the right to do that. And then finally, also very important, I think, in the OR context, we have a set of promises in our policy that say if you use the final issued work from OASIS that is a specification that's been approved, then you are entitled to use it for a wide variety of purposes. And that is a clear, permanent, irrevocable promise that once we get all the way through the standards process and aggregate all those contributions into a piece of work, and then that work is approved, that others can freely reuse it. Let's go to the next slide. Now, this is the same thing, but it's a workflow, and I don't necessarily claim this to be UML or even artistic, but I just wanted to make a point visually about the various obligations and how they interact. Up in the upper left corner, we have members. We're looking at slide 9. They give us stuff. That's our contributions are publicly posted. You can't give us anything unless the PC writes it to a list where the public can see it, so our inputs are transparent. They are required to subject that to a license and a disclosure obligation, which gives OASIS certain rights to republish it at that time. The work progresses under a scope statement, and under process rules, so that the activity of analyzing those contributions and reading them and aggregating them into drafts is bounded by something that's declared. And it's also public. In other words, if we create a committee to create a data specification for something and they go off and instead try and write a peace treaty for the Middle East, that's out of scope, and all of these various obligations aren't going to apply to it. So the scoping work, which is also transparent, matters. As the committee progresses, and I'm moving from left to right in this picture, it writes drafts. Each of the drafts is publicly readable. Each of the drafts, at the conclusion of that draft, is also committed to OASIS via an automatic provision that says that we have certain rights in it. And so over time, each draft becomes part of essentially the body of material that we're entitled to share with the public. Towards the middle right of the graph, the public also, as I said, has provisions subject to a slightly different, much simpler license. It's basically, they can do whatever you want. I'm reserving no rights in it. Those can be read by the public. Those also may be put into the draft. And eventually, finally, all the way to the right in this timeline, there's a final approved piece of work, which also is published, and to that we have gathered at each of those steps throughout that process to aggregate it, to republish it, but also to issue a plenary license that says anyone may use this thing, and all the people contributed to it support and will, to the extent necessary, accept to make available their rights to support that use. So the point here is not that this particular system should be copied, but rather, the life cycle of development of the piece's work and aggregation and derivation requires that you have promises and filters at each step to make sure that your inputs have proper rights and your outputs have proper rights, so that you get all the way to the end that you can do that one thing, which is what we're really trying to do, up at the end of the final document. It can be read and used and derived from by the public freely. Fear of conflict with the folks who helped create it. I'm now going to mention two special issues quickly and then close. Next slide, please. I want to mention a word about federation. We are talking in the OR project about a federated system, which I mean broadly to mean the very set of server under Peter Yin's desk, but the post organization that keeps a bunch of policy meetings, and everybody goes and gets them from Peter's desk. We're talking instead about an arrangement by which ontology owners can self-publish, and they self-publish something to a federation arrangement so that they are available mutually in a coordinated system, and an outside query can look at all of them or compare them or look across them and treat them as a body of work, even though they're actually all self-published. That is, in a nutshell, how I understand federation. There are some folks who are doing things like this. I mentioned the U.S. NIST e-business standards repository as one early and interesting effort to get a whole bunch of different standard organizations all to put their metadata in one place so that NIST can display them and have apples-to-apples pointers to the benefit of various standards audiences in the United States. But doing federation requires you to do some specific things. You need to work on your scope. You need to know that you're collecting sufficient rights from each self-publisher that you can faithfully represent back to the end users that the stuff is all available on safe terms. And finally, you need to have a stable governance framework for the federation as well as for the ontology themselves. I'm using this to raise questions at this time. I'm going to tell you that I think it's a great question showing up in the chat. And these are things we're going to have to solve. I'm in the luxury of not having to answer them today, but rather just to pose some of the questions. Next slide, please. Another important issue, which I believe may come up in the OOR project as we've been following, but there is some thought that quality information or evaluative information about the ontologies will be posted and shared in a sort of a ratings system framework. That also requires some special attention because somebody owns the aggregated reputational data is responsible for faithfully reporting it. Somebody has the problem of making sure that the various raters are all contributing data that can be validly aggregated logically so as to create intelligible scores or results. And somebody has to control it and make sure that it runs. I've just mentioned to you the obvious case of website auction company self-propelled vendor ratings and customer ratings using eBay as an example, which I assume many are familiar with, where eBay is not rating its sellers, but it is inviting ratings of sellers to be aggregated and then faithfully reporting the aggregate results of those ratings, which basically creates some more overhead for eBay, and it's overhead I'm pointing out here. I've also given a link here to a standards project at Oasis where a group is attempting in an identity framework context to create some specifications for open sharing of reputational data between systems. So there is some work in the area, but the point of this slide is simply that if we're going to do ratings, just as if we're going to do federation, it will put some other requirements on us. Next slide, please. That's all I've got to say, and I want to thank you deeply for your patience. I think this is a wonderful project. We're enthused to be a part of helping to define it, and I'm very much looking forward to hearing what the other wonderful experts on this panel, who I'm honored to be with, have to say. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Jamie. That's a great start. So without further ado, let us call upon John Wilbanks to tell us about licensing and ontologies, what they find from their research at Creative Commons.
So let's go ahead to slide 2.
Okay.
So just a quick bit of background on Creative Commons. We are a nonprofit organization, and what we do is provide standardized licenses, or probably best known for our copyright licenses, which are a modular set of copyright licenses. The underlying core right is the right to make non-commercial copies of copyrighted works. And then to that, you can attach certain restrictions or additional freedoms. You can allow the right to make commercial copies. You can restrict the right or perfect to make derivative works, and you can impose a share-alike or copyleft style requirement. The licenses are in 3 versions. One is what we call the layperson or the human-readable version. One is the legal text, the lawyer-readable version, and we also provide a machine-readable version using the RDFA specification. The licenses cover a lot of objects on the web, ranging from the White House to Wikipedia and all sorts of other stuff, but these are non-software objects. These are cultural works, things like photographs, text, music, film, and so forth. I specifically work in the Science Commons piece of Creative Commons, and we explore the applications of the CC licenses in the sciences. It goes from looking at the way the copyright licenses create open access to scholarly literature, but also into what we should be doing around things like data, ontology, biological materials licensing, and most recently into patent licensing. And so I'll put a link to the license suite into the chat so you can take a look at them if you are interested. And let's go to the next slide, slide 3, please. So just a quick thing about me, so you know where I'm coming from. I am currently the VP for Science here at CC. In the past, I've been at the consortium where I helped start the Semantic Web for Life Sciences project. I started and ran a company called Infelico. We were an early semantic database company in the life sciences and pharma industry. And I was at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society in its early days at Harvard Law School. Slide 4, please. This is really important. I am actually not a lawyer, unlike Jamie. And so this isn't legal advice. None of the stuff Creative Commons does represent legal advice. This is simply the result of a multi-year research project we've been doing on what we think might be the best practices for licensing ontology. What I'm going to say here is not a set of recommendations for OOR. but simply the results of the research that we've been doing. And we haven't published this yet. We're in the process of taking an internal memo written by lawyers after the legal research and turning that into a public document. Bye-bye. So the research has been informed by a lot of technical and legal expertise. So Alan Ruttenberg and Jonathan Reese, who are full-time employees and scientists at Creative Commons. Alan was the co-chair of the OWL2 working group at the Web Consortium, as well as a core member of the Open Biomedical Ontologies Foundry and many other ontology systems. And Jonathan sits on the TAG at the Web Consortium as well. And we receive advisory advice from people like Hal Abelson and Benedita, who are both originally out of MIT and play pretty important roles in the semantic web and other systems. At the level, I am dependent on Tin Nguyen and Diane Peters. Tin is the counsel for Science Commons. Diane is general counsel for Creative Commons, as well as board members Larry Lessig, Jamie Boyle, and Mike Carroll. Slide 6. So everything we're doing here has been informed by practice. We didn't do this in a vacuum. So if you go to neurocommons.org, you'll see what this lecture. What you'll see is that we've spent a significant amount of time and effort actually trying to take open ontologies and redistribute them. Slide 7, please. So this is a link, and you can follow to the RDF distribution from the front page of NeuroCommons. We took an enormous amount of existing, quote-unquote, open biological ontologies and other sorts of ontologies and put them into a combined RDF distribution in which we used those ontologies to do a pretty significant amount of data mapping, data federation, and then to redistribute that as a modular bundled distribution. The idea being you should be able to build an integrated set of databases in much the same way that you build an installation of Linux. And so that what you see under ontologies, we're actually redistributing everything from brain architecture management systems to ad hoc ontologies that we wrote to non-biological things like the W3C SCoF and pushing those things back out. So we've learned a lot in looking at terms of use and licensing on ontologies that have informed what we're going to be talking about today. Slide 8, please. So the research that we've done is specifically on the use of licenses in ontology. There's a lot of stuff that goes on around things like terms of use. There's a lot of things that go on in terms of norms that are currently used to regulate ontology. Those aren't really in scope in our research. We were specifically even looking at the use of Creative Commons copyright licenses in ontologies. We also haven't looked extensively at trademarks, patents, and the sorts of systemic interactions with policy that Jamie talked about, which are all really important. So I want to keep emphasizing the narrow nature of the research we've been doing. Slide. So there's a lot of lawyer stuff that we could talk about in terms of whether or not an ontology is likely to be found copyrightable by the courts. Suffice to say, it's complicated to apply the traditional sort of doctrine of the copyrightability to ontologies because they're supposed to perhaps represent functional or factual knowledge. They have functions themselves. And so there's some arguments that could be made that these things are not themselves copyrightable. But the quotes that we kept coming back to in our research came out of the American Dental Association versus Delta Dental Plants Association case, and I've extracted a couple of the key quotes to that. And again, everyone can view this stuff differently. That's how the law sort of works. But the first ones that we stick to are the idea that classification is a creative endeavor, and because you can express a scheme of classification in multiple ways, that choice represents a spark of creativity, which is, from your conservative reading, means that there's a good chance the courts might find this copyrighted. Slide 10, please. Here are the other quotes that we sort of that stuck out to us. So that a taxonomy is a way of describing items in a body of knowledge. It's not just a collection of bits and pieces of reality. And so, given that this is a case that is likely to be key to any litigated case about the anthology copyright question. And we think a conservative reading of this, we have a good chance that there'll be a copyright found in some, at least some anthologies. And the worry is that there might be a willingness to grant really broad copyright in anthology, and that it might be difficult or impossible to separate fact and expression in the use of anthology. And the problem is that that might lead to the assumption that broad copyright applies to all ontologies, which could perhaps chill research and reduce opportunities for use of them. Subtle. Okay. So I'm not going to get into the details of the law. There's a lot of detail, but the main point is that what copyright is used for is to govern the copying and the distribution of the copyrighted works. And frequently in licensing, what we do is leverage the desire that people have to copy and distribute to sort of compel certain amounts of use. That's really why we use licenses in the first place. And the bias that I have here is that interoperability is the first principle of ontology. That's where sort of the science commons position emerges from, is that the uses really come around the interoperability of the license. And those uses don't map super neatly to copyright all the time. So let's go to slide 12, please. So these are iconic descriptions of the core restrictions that can be attached to the underlying Creative Commons copyright license grant, which is, as I said, the right to make non-commercial copies. So the little guy there from the upper left distribution, the dollar sign is a non-commercial restriction, the equal sign is a ban on making any derivatives, and the upper right sort of inverted copyright is the requirement that you can make derivatives, but if you do, then you have to share back your works on the same terms. So the question is, what's the impact that each of these terms has on the interoperability of a given ontology because of its legal status? Slide 13. So what keeps coming out in the research are three rights that are desired by thirds of ontology. So the first is a right to use, the use in the sense of linking to or copying definitions or objects. And that maps pretty clearly to the right to make copies, because there are some instances where you simply want to refer to the ontology. What we learned in the NeuroCommons work is that in a lot of cases, you need to be able to download a local copy and then use that ontology if you're going to do things like mapping and querying. Another one is the right to use the definitions in an ontology, either in their original context or in a new context. And that maps to the right to make derivative works. And then the last is the right to use the ontology in a reason. And again, it's important to have a local copy cached of the ontology if you're going to make that use happen. Slide 14. So the derivative works question really comes up again and again. And there are two kinds of core derivative works that we identified in our practice. One is, if we want to map two ontologies to each other, it is useful not simply to distribute that as links and references to ontologies that are on the web, because once you've done the mapping, if the original folks who distributed the ontology make changes, that can break the mapping. You need to distribute the ontologies to which you made the mapping at the time you made the mapping. And this is both a derivative works question as well as a quality control question, which is, you may have fixed bugs in the ontology after I did the mapping. So you have both a derivative works thing, which is a copyright question, and a quality control question, which is hard to regulate using the copyright license. Another one is the desire to change a definition. I can tell you that consensus in the ontology community about definitions is occasionally difficult to achieve, which will not be a surprise to anyone who's been in ontology argument. And so in many cases, people would like to take something like what we've created at the NeuroCommons and change it because they disagree with our position on ontological realism, for example. And so trademark is one way to manage integrity in this sort of thing, but there's often a desire to use copyright. Whether that's good or bad is sort of not the question. It's that people believe they can use it. We've become accustomed from free culture, open access, and open source to using copyright licenses to achieve sometimes social goals. But we do think the changes to OWL files themselves may well trigger derivative work obligations, which means that, addressing derivative works in the licensing structure for ontologies generally may be an important concept. Slide 15, please. So in looking at clauses like non-commercial, no derivatives, and share-alike, we actually think that each of these restrictions creates significant risks to interoperability. It is very hard to, first of all, non-commercial and no derivatives are not accepted open source clauses. The Creative Commons licenses that leverage these two are not open source or open access licenses. They're not certified as free culture licenses. Right? These are simply things that make non-commercial exact copies possible. And given how little we understand what's going to happen in the ontology space, applying these sorts of restrictions is likely to really mess up the desired goal of interoperability and our expectation. We certainly have been unable to use ontologies to carry non-commercial or no derivatives restrictions as freely as we would like to. And there's also a question of what happens. Do you pass those terms down when you process the ontology to get the data? Similarly to copyleft, it's unclear to us what copyleft means in the ontology space, and we think there's a risk of people believing it propagates down to processed data, databases that are structured using ontology, and other sorts of things that might be contemplated as derivative works. So we, like Creative Commons, provide each of these clauses. We have actually come to the conclusion that in ontology context, each of these pose a significant interoperability risk. And I have an interoperability typo, which is beautiful. All right, slide 16. One of the questions that, has to be answered is, do you want to treat ontologies under an open source regime, an access regime? And I'm grateful to George for, setting this up so nicely. And it really comes to whether we view the ontology as a piece of software or as a document. And that would really govern which one you would use. So here at slide 17, which is there are some ways in which ontologies are like software. They're embodied in files, particularly the OWL file format. And of course, documents are embodied in document files like .doc, but OWL is actually often and most useful when it's used alongside software for computation. So there's an argument, and certainly when you come from George's perspective earlier that as computer scientists, these things maybe ought to be treated as software. And that would argue for choosing an open source license, such as the ones that are approved under the open source definition or certified by OSI, the open source definition. Slide 18. There are, however, attributes of documentation to ontology. They're not usually carrying along separate source code and binary forms, which is a core attribute of software licenses, is that they deal with things like source code and binary. One of the things about the CC licenses is we specifically don't address source code and binary because we don't want our licenses used for software. And the other thing is that you find as you talk to, other scientists, there's a fair amount of belief that and norms of practice that, refer to ontologies as a form of documentation, as a way of writing down structures that, that represent community agreement as opposed to something that is itself because an executable object. And if that is where you wind up in looking at your ontology, you may want to choose an open access license like a CC license or one of the other open access licenses that are out there. So slide 19, in conclusion. And we're going to be publishing a memo on this in the coming weeks and months. We'll, of course, forward that out to, the OOR group. The number one preliminary conclusion is to talk to your lawyer. And there needs to be a lawyer involved whose job it is to really think this through on behalf of whoever is trying to distribute it. Because it's complicated, and there are a lot of, irreducible choices that you have to make. Are you going to treat it as a document? Are you going to treat it as software? Are you going to go for interoperability as a principle, or is the goal to compel behavior as a principle? If you do look at interoperability as, the key, then we do think that the share-alike non-derives and non-commercial clauses, whether ours or anyone else's, pose threats to interoperability. we do think that attribution licenses scale best in an interoperability context, whether that's open source or open access. And in terms of dealing with patents, what's come up again and again is that the W3C's patent policy is really well regarded in this space. So the issue really comes down to how much you expect to have copies made of your ontologies, how much you expect that people can make those copies, make changes to the ontologies, and what behaviors you'd like to enable or compel. So I'll stop there.
Thank you, John. I mean, glad you did all that research. Saves us a lot of time and energy, and really glad Creative Commons is part of this team. So without further ado, let us bring on Bruce Perrin's slides. So under his slides, I mean, he sent us an open ODP formatted slide, and if your browser only supports PDF, click on the PDF link instead. So, Bruce?
Well, thank you very much, Peter, and I'll echo the other participants in saying that it's a privilege and an honor to participate in this process. Peter, can you go to the first slide? Here we go. So that's slide number one, and as it says, I am a strategic consultant today on open source issues. About half of my income comes from law firms and the rest corporations and governments. And way back about 12 years ago, I was one of the founders of the open source movement. Now, that doesn't mean I created open source. There was this guy, Richard Stallman, first popularized free software around 1984, and open source stands upon Richard's shoulders. However, there was a lot of work in the open source movement to bring this software and paradigm to industry, which had not taken place before. So I've had great fun with that. I remember one day I just announced open source to the world, and here we are 12 years later, and it's a very, very big thing. So I've had my 15 minutes of fame. Next slide, number two, please. Okay, so let's talk about open source licensing, because this is something that we're all dealing with, but it is very misunderstood. First of all, open source provides three critical rights, really, and these are the right to use, the right to redistribute, and the right to modify. And these are specific rights in copyright law. So when I say you have the right to use, that means you have the right to run the program. See? Creating a derivative work is its own right, and that's contained within the right to modify. And we have to be very careful when we discuss these rights that we don't confuse ourselves about them. The open source licenses, if they are to be considered open source, must comply with the definition at opensource.org, OSD.html, and this is a document that I originally created in June of 1997 for the Debian project. And about 8 months later, there was a meeting, which is reasonably famous, and the day after that, Eric Raymond called me up and said, let's found this thing called open source. And I said, well, hey, I've already got the rules because I wrote them for a Linux distribution, and that is what has become the open source definition today. Next slide, please. That's number three, although I can't see the numbers here. So can you open source the ontology? We were lucky enough to have both of our previous speakers discuss this a little. But I want this to be very clearly understood that there are deep legal questions. And what we think today is that copyright law probably cannot be used to restrict the use of an ontology or the creation of an ontology that refers to another ontology. However,
if you just send out a copy of the ontology as if you were copying an OASIS standard, perhaps that can be restricted. And what we do, since there are a lot of questions in the law, is we don't count on any legal restrictions that we might not actually have, and we design our process, including our choice of open source licensing, so that we're not misleading ourselves. So what you use the open source licensing for in that case, eliminating the questions by unambiguously licensing rights to others that they actually have already, but we're going to make it very clear with our license. Now, you probably can't use open source licensing to restrict derivative works of ontologies because there's a lot of argument that they are not derivative. A simple reference to another ontology is probably not derivative. This is also a question for open source software. If you GPL the library, could you restrict an application that's proprietary from making use of it because it's a derivative work? This question's still not answered today. So the use of the GPL and other reciprocal licenses probably cannot be enforced on ontologies as they can be on software. Next slide, please. And the heading on this slide is, what can you do? What you can do first is enforce what are often called moral rights, which are attribution of the author, and author integrity, in that modified work must make clear that they aren't the author's work. And we should note that copyright and patent are not the only mechanisms that you can use. Trademarks are very useful for author integrity, in that you can license that something can be called by a particular name as long as it is the real McCoy. And if it is modified, another name must be used. And you can use trademark law to enforce that. Beyond that, you can try to get a patent for your ontology, and this presents all sorts of problems that we won't get into. I'd love to see someone discuss that someday. Next slide, please. By the way, I'm not an attorney, although I do very much work for attorneys, and I often teach credit courses on open source to attorneys. I did participate in the W3C patent policy board, the one that's reasonably well regarded by this group, and I believe John was with W3C at the time and have done a whole lot of involvement in open source policy over the past 12, 13 years. There's a much stronger legal foundation to the application of open source licensing to software because we have lots of cases about software licensing before open source, and we now have a few cases that we can cite that are about open source. Now, you may note that there are lawsuits concerning open source all of the time. Most of them, in fact, are about a piece of software that I created called BusyBox, although the suits are brought by later developers of that program. However, all of those suits have settled under seal, which means that you can't read the text. You can just read a press release about the case and make your own guesses. So this is kind of useless as far as citing it in another case. However, there was one U.S. enforcement case called Jacobson versus Katzer. Started out as a patent case and ended up being a copyright case. It went to the Federal Circuit Appeals Court, and the open source developer, Jacobson, actually took a smaller settlement because he insisted that the case not be sealed and thus would be available to us to cite about open source licensing in later cases. All the enforcement cases about open source licensing so far have dealt with a total failure. What this means is that people knew or should have known that they had an obligation to distribute source code They didn't do it. They didn't distribute the author's attribution. They didn't present licenses when they were supposed to. So all of these cases have really been about no-brainers, which also gives you one of the reasons that they settled, because when these went to court, the violators really had no defense. And unfortunately, that's in big companies like Verizon, for example, is one of them. Next slide, please. So there are three fundamental kinds of open source licensing. The first is what I call gift licensing, and that includes the BSD and MIT licenses, which pretty much say, put my author attribution in this and do anything you once you've done that. And then there's the Apache license, which says that and also has some language patents, because open source is constantly threatened by software patenting. It's really the only thing that can break the paradigm in that, unfortunately, you can patent mathematics today, and then you can essentially keep anyone else from using it. So the GIF licenses pretty much give away all rights, and you can take that software and employ it in a proprietary program and not distribute source code and make lots of money on it, and the authors are okay with that. Then we have the other paradigm, which has had many names, some of them nasty, but which I call share and share alike or reciprocal licensing. And all this says is, here's software, and I've given you a very big set of rights, and if you make an addition, a modification to this software, please put the same set of rights on your modification that I gave you. So, share and share alike. This is also called copyleft. And if you want to be pejorative about it, you can call it viral. I've heard that one a lot, or contaminating. But actually, these are things that we learn to do with others in kindergarten, share and share alike. And then there is a something in between license. And for this, we usually use the lesser or library GPL license. And the purpose of that is to make a work in part free, but also usable as a component of proprietary software. And again, if you do that and you follow some reasonably simple requirements, the creator of the free part doesn't mind your using it in your proprietary software. So we have the three types, GIFT, share and share alike, and something in between. Next slide, please. So when would you use GIFT licensing? Well, when you're creating a standard is a really important time, because a reference platform for a standard often embodies the way you want everyone to do something if they're following your standard. And thus, you should put very minimal IP requirements at reference platform so that everyone can copy it into their proprietary software, use a very simple license that does not give lawyers headaches and that is not ambiguous. And another time to use GIFT licensing is when you've already been paid. And if someone has paid you to produce a work, for example, the United States government paid the University of California at Berkeley to extend Unix, and this became the BSD system, which is familiar to lots of people, BSD Unix, and they released that under the BSD license, which gave all of the taxpayers who had already paid for the work the maximal utility from the software. And this, I feel, was a really good prototype of how taxpayer-paid scientific research should be handled. The taxpayers should get the maximal utility of the work they've already paid for. And another reason to use GIFT licensing is when continuing control of the work isn't important. If you don't care other people modify it, maybe you're not going to stay in the project. That's a good time. But remember, a gift is a gift. And if people are using it in proprietary software and they're doing so in compliance with your terms, don't complain later. Next slide, please. The heading is when to use share and share alike licensing. So share and share alike, the GPL and other such licenses. If you want derivative works to themselves be open source. So let's go back to BusyBox. I put about a month of evenings into writing it, and when it was finished, it had about 35 different commands. And I sent it out to the world, and two embedded systems companies picked it up. One was Monta Vista, and the other was called Linio, and it is used widely in embedded Linux. It's in all of your access points today, etc. But those two companies took my software because they got a time-to-market improvement by not writing their own. And my software did not represent what was business differentiating about their offering. So writing their own really wasn't an economic value to them. But because my software was under a share-alike license, they took all of the additions they made to this program and made them available under the GPL. So the program now has about 150 commands. It's much larger than it was before and much more functional. So I essentially got about 4 man-years work by other companies contributed to open source in return from my 1 month and my using the GPL software. So that was very effective, I felt. But be warned about this share and share like licensing. There are ways to circumvent the restrictions of the GPL. I give corporations, interesting, a list of 4 of them and a long explanation of how they work. And you can create proprietary works that aren't considered to be derivative in the law, but work as if they were. And the GPL doesn't really touch them. Now, whether someone does that or not, of course, is very much in question. Okay, next slide, please. So when do you use something in between gift and share alike? Well, software libraries are a great example. So, for example, the C library on the Linux system is a library that every application must use, no matter what language it's written in. And that library is under the LGPL. And what that says is, hey, it's okay, write your proprietary application, sell it, no problem here. And if you modify the C library itself, gives back the software. So we're all working on the same copy. And that's been very effective because if we share development among multiple companies, we get much more development of the software than we would otherwise. We have to make sure that when we share our development, that what we're working on is a portion of the software that isn't business differentiating for our company. It doesn't make our products better than someone else's products to the customer. As long as we understand that, using share and share alike licensing and using open source in general for that piece makes perfect sense. So when's another time to use share and share alike licensing? Language interpreters very often the LGPL, a lot of these interpretive runtime languages use it, and also a lot of Java software uses it because Java software does get linked together, and sometimes the developers don't want to have a question that their work in some way encumbers something else that is linked into it, and thus they use this LGPL license. So that it's open source, it's weakly reciprocal, weakly share and share alike, but not encumbering. And what we see when control of the original work but not derivative works is important, and that's really important to these folks who write the Linux C library, because they want all users of that library to be compatible across multiple Linux distributions, etc. Next slide, please. The heading on this is choosing a suite of licenses. So you choose three licenses from those three basic types of GIF, share, care alike, something in between. Make sure that the three that you choose are compatible with each other. Unfortunately, we have about 70 accepted open source licenses in the world, and apparently actually 1,300 if you believe the statements of BlackBuck. These are not necessarily compatible with each other in their terms, so making sure the licenses that you use are compatible with each other is a way to prevent yourself from having problems. You'll still run into those sort of problems when you write software that is contributed to other projects. But remember, if you are the copyright holder of the entire contribution, you can apply any number of licenses to it. Next slide, please. So let's talk about a couple licenses that are of note. The GPL is a prototypical share and share alike license. GPL 3 is a rewrite of earlier GPL versions to meet changes in the law. So if you consider GPL was written in the 80s, at that time the most complicated input device in a home was a touch-tone phone. And we listened to music on CDs or black vinyl records. So we had a great revolution in digital intellectual property since that time, with a lot of law and a lot of case law. And GPL 3 takes the intent of GPL 2, which is the one we've been using since the 80s, and makes it meet the changes in law. It also takes on some issues that we felt were threatening. For example, digital rights management. However, although GPL 3 restricts digital rights management implementations, I can show you how to use GPL 3 software legally without breaking your DRM. It provides more rights, GPL 3, to combine with proprietary software than GPL 2 does in some cases. For example, when an API is covered by a standard, the implementer of that API can be proprietary software, and GPL 3 is fine with that. Next slide, please. And the heading of this slide, again, is licenses of note of GPL. This is a special version of the GPL license that handles the issue of services that are performed but not distributed, as is Google, what we used to call software as a service. And it turns out copyright law does not define a public performance right for software. It defines it for music and theater and movies, but not software. So the GPL goes through some contortions to make it that when someone only performs software and does not distribute it, they can be constrained to still provide the source code for that software. And our GPL is available in both a GPL 2 and a GPL 3 version. And then we have Creative Commons, which is already spoken for itself, and I just wanted to say a little more about the relationship of Creative Commons to open source. As John said, some of the Creative Commons licenses are open source and some are not, and the only right I see in common between the various Creative Commons licenses is the right to read. So that makes it very different from open source, in that open source takes a set of rights and lays them out and says, you can have all of these or you don't call it an open source license. Creative Commons really has won. Okay, so John Wilbanks says the core right is the right to make non-commercial copies. Okay, next slide, please. All right, compliance is something you have to consider. If you ever modify or redistribute open source, you must make sure to comply with the license terms. Reproduce the attribution. Make sure people see a copyright statement and the author's name somewhere in your documentation, or it's presented by your software. Convey the license and any required notices to others. This is required more by the reciprocal licenses than the gift ones, but consider the license terms. Provide source code if the license requires that. And in the case of the GPL, the requirement is that source code be provided either with the binary version or for a period of 3 years after the binary is distributed to anyone. You can provide the source code for the exact version, so that may mean you have multiple versions of source code that you're distributing, just as you distributed multiple binary versions, and also license derivative works as required by the license. Now, I mentioned before that there are still ambiguous legal issues regarding open source, and we don't necessarily know, for example, if certain ways of connecting your application to GPL software make it a derivative work or not. So what I do with my customers is we always err on the conservative side of this question, and we do what the licensor intended us to do. And in general, my approach to customers is we're not out to win cases. We're out to prevent cases from ever being filed and people from ever having grievances. And this doesn't necessarily work perfectly. Next slide, please. Okay, and I actually see number 14 here. Can you stay in control? No, you can't really stay in control of open source if it's under a real open source license. Only while you're perceived as an effective developer and leader of the project will the rest of the developers hang out with you and submit directly to you their changes. And that's a really important thing. For example, we had a guy who was in charge of the X-Free86 website and decided that he wanted to tighten up on the rights to the X Windows system, and we all walked off, essentially, and moved it to X.org and don't really concern ourselves with what this fellow has to say anymore. So sometimes it is important for our project to be able to abscond, and historically, forks were criticized as a very harmful component of open source, but if you look at when forks have actually happened, they've proven to be very beneficial. And the fact that you can make a fork without signing any contracts about it has saved many projects. However, what this means is if you want to stay in control of your open source project, you need a continuing investment into its development. Next slide, please. Dual licensing is something that's famous because MySQL was a dual licensing business, and they were sold to Sun for $1.1 billion. The founders each walked off with about $120 billion after 9 years of work. MySQL was essentially by one guy, so that's an incredibly successful business despite all the really bad things that have happened since Sun bought it. And the dual licensing paradigm means that the copyright holder releases both the commercially licensed version and an open source version of the program. And generally that open source version is under a maximally restrictive license like a Pharo GPL 3. So the commercial license is a sort of get-out-of-jail card that lets you make commercial derivative works without any legal questions about them. And dual licensing has the complication that the copyright holder can't accept contributions without either copyright assignment or the right to relicense, because that copyright holder has to be able to make both licenses. So dual licensing does not often result in an effective community for its development. However, there are cases in which it's still very useful. Next slide, please. Developers historically have been reluctant to hand their copyrights over to dual licensing projects because nobody's tried to give them any motivation to do so. For example, they're not paid for their contributions, and they're not given any other consideration in return. For example, the core developers don't promise to keep it open once you give it their copyright. So people generally have a problem doing that. Next slide, please. Fallacies about open source. Open source restricts commercial use. No, it doesn't. Open source licenses explicitly don't restrict use. Use is running the program. They do restrict the creation of proprietary derivative works. Open source, because you can get it for free, can poison the potential to make much money from selling an identical program. But they don't prevent income from service, etc. Next slide, please. And this is slide 18. Our fallacies about open source. You can't put open source software in a proprietary product. Well, sure you can. There's always a way to separate your business differentiating software from the open source that's not a derivative work. Get expert help. We know how to do this. And we can tell your lawyer. All of the cases of open source license enforcement so far has been regarding really stupid non-compliance issues like failure to distribute the source code at all. We don't have the problems with commercial derivative works that have been stated. Next slide, please. Okay, necessary policies for a project like this. Determine the acceptable open source licenses for the project. Make sure they're all compatible with each other. Determine if the project will own all the copyrights or if the various contributors will individually own copyrights. If copyrights are distributed among many contributors, the consequence is that you can't change the license later. Many people feel that's a feature, not a bug. Create and enforce a patent policy for members that submit material, not just software, but standards, committee input, etc. It must, at a minimum, prevent submarine patents owned by project participants from encumbering the project. There's an old case that's cited a lot, Rambus versus Infineon, where they said that Rambus gave them a lot of standards material, and then it turned out that it was all patented by Rambus. So many companies ended up having to pay Rambus to implement a memory bus, which is still widely used. Look at W3C's policy. It's a pretty good place to start, although it has its compromises. And even with its compromises, one project participant, Phillips, walked off of W3C rather than work within the policy. Next slide, please. And do some legal homework. Remember, I'm not your lawyer. Get a reality check from counsel on application of copyright law to ontologies. Maybe years or decades for cases to make these issues work, because your lawyer isn't really going to have the answer. Next slide, please. And at this point, I think, Peter, you'd like to go to questions and answers for all the speakers. Is that right?
Yes. Yes. Thank you very much, Bruce. That is wonderful. And I guess everyone can hear me, right? Yeah. Okay. So we've already got a lot of questions lined up on the chat board already. So may I ask everyone who wants to pose a question to click on the hand button now. That way we can line people up for Q&A. So I've got one hand from Ravi.
Do you want me to ask the question now?
Okay, let's hang on one moment. I don't see George on the chat board. So, George, are you still on the call? Star 3?
Sorry.
Yes. Oh, great. Yes. You did mention you have a few you might have a few questions for the panel. You might. Shall we start with your questions, possibly?
Good idea.
Well, I'm intrigued by the. I'd like to hear a little more discussion from the panelists about whether or not ontologies are going to be copyrightable and are they going to be patentable?
The jury's still out. Jamie's on.
You go ahead. It's Jamie. I'd love to hear what you have to say on that, and I have a comment too.
You mean you'd love to hear what Bruce has to say?
How's that?
Okay, I think that was for me. The jury is still out on this issue. I think that there's, let me read you something in copyright law. USC 17.1.102.b says, in no case does copyright protection for an original work of authorship extend to any idea, procedure, process, system, method of operation, test, principle, or discovery, regardless of the form in which it's described, explained, illustrated, or embodied in such a work. And the intent of this is to take those things and send them in the direction of patent law in some cases. So we have exactly one case about this, which John, I think, discussed, ADA versus Delta Dental. And the result of that case was that Delta Dental could not distribute copies of the taxonomy that ADA had created about dental surgery. However, the ADA couldn't stop dentists from using the ADA code in their forms and records or stop Delta Dental from distributing forms that invited dentists to use the ADA's code. So even in the one case that we have, there are some parts of copyright law that were not applied, that you might apply to software. So I think that this is going to be a question for potentially decades, and that's all I have to say.
Bruce, if you can type out your conclusion on the chat board, that will get documented, which will be useful. Going on to Jamie, yes.
Starting with the IANANL. You know, I have two thoughts about this, and I don't think they conflict with each other. We'll see. The first one is that I'd like the answer personally to be that this stuff is not patentable. The patent regime has been falling down all over the place and getting more in the way of than facilitating. A lot of things are happening in our data and software sphere. Not personally inclined to indulge in behaviors that drag that family further into the tent than ever did. And so I think one of our questions that we face to the community is how to proceed without making things worse. one of the problems with creating a huge, complicated prophylactic that says, here's how to deal with camels, is that you tend to get more camels that way. So I think we'll need, as we get into your second, third session, to think more about how to proceed in uncertainty without unnecessarily surrendering or creating an impression that this group endorses the application of tax law in a particular spirit where it has not yet clearly taken hold. Now, having said that, because we are in an uncertain situation, and will be for some time, because I want to remind you all that U.S. law is in a way the primary source for rules and risks that will affect the project that has global reach. And these practices vary from country to country. Since we're in an uncertain time, I think the thing we can do is design procedures that would do a serviceable job of extinguishing the risks that this project's requirements want to extinguish, assuming that the policy did eventually become clearly tangible. I don't think we can stick our heads in the sand and say, not going to happen, isn't going to apply, shouldn't apply, therefore we're not going to protect against it. I think you protect against it and then evaluate your protection for its effect on the debate at the end. Thanks.
Thanks. John, anything to add to the mix?
We might have lost him.
Oh, Will, thanks. All right.
It's going to be another meeting, I'm afraid.
Okay. All right. So let's go on. You have further questions, George, or shall I go on to the queue?
Please go on.
All right. I will take people in the order of the hands, but let me remind everyone that this is only the first of the three sessions, so we are trying to get a lay of the land today. So let's restrict the questions to that and leave the discussion on issues relating to OR or even to ontologies to next week's session. And obviously our third session is the one that we will try to reach consensus on. So on that note, Ravi, star 3 to unmute, test your voice and begin.
Yes, Peter.
Yes, go ahead, Ravi. We can hear you. Yes.
First, very profuse, very, very strong thanks to George for setting the stage. Dr. Strong, you really did. I also noted that on the chat board. Other speakers did. We all join them in thanking you. Second is that this very question that you raised about the ontology, copyrightable or patentable, was raised just a few minutes earlier in the chat board, and we got a few responses from participants. The gist of it seems to be that it is difficult to patent ontologies. Ontologies are like a depiction of a process or a depiction of nature of things and the relationships among things. So it is very hard to encapsulate, although there are upper and then detailed ontologies that connect downward, but some relationships can't be patented, some objects can't be patented, and therefore we hope that the whole ontology would stay out in open regime. Only exception I can think are of nature of bioinformatics sequences that can lead to life-saving pharmaceuticals where, say, the drug development companies may have to put out very, very large sums before they see returns on investment. So that's my comment in short. More in the other sessions, and thank you.
Thank you, Rafi. Yuri?
Yes.
Star 3.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for the very interesting session. I have one question. I try to understand, is ontology looks like a text or language? Because as I know, the language has no copyright or even dictionary, but text can be copyrighted. Of course, it can be represented as a text, which is copyrighted. About if you consider that ontology is something like idea, which belongs to another holder, God or whatever, who has the right to give us the idea of the language. What do you think?
Who would you like to address the question to? Or do we want our panelists to take it one at a time?
The panelists, maybe from because we try to be more common ideas or approach.
Okay.
If some has idea, because if they don't understand the common sense of the ontology, how can you ontology decide the text or language in the beginning? The idea or the something created by human mind that is human and can be copyrighted by human or things.
So, Bruce or Jamie, would either one of you like to take this up?
Jamie, why don't you try that? I mean,
yes. One of the main reasons that people commit work to the public, there's a bunch of them. Yeah, and it applies to open constitutions, it applies to open standards, it applies to a bunch of things that are just sort of put out in the public generally and published and shared, whether under any regime or not. They're very aware of the fact that by putting it out there, they're time stamping it, generally making it more difficult for someone to come along later and say embedded it. So, I have to say, I think that regardless of all this legal falderal of people who spend their life worrying about license or specific terms or the control of a particular host or organization. I think we ought to generally, in our broadest community, act in a way that encourages and doesn't deaden that impulse. There's a deep quality-oriented communitarian motivation behind a lot of the activity in the sector, and where do we have freedom of choice, we should be designing so as to continue to support it. Now, having said that, as George pointed out in his remarks, we have laws and regimes in most nations, including the United States, that give some people some rights to hold things exclusively if they choose to do so for some period of time. And I would see any government taking the position that that's wrong. The problem is how to make those systems predictable and fair and or mitigate their aspects of them that might be overreaching. If you use U.S. patent policy as an example, shortly after the incursion of patent work into software, decade or two ago, there was some work trying to reform some aspect of patent review and the method which was considered. So even the PTO in the U.S. is very patent-oriented, very patent-friendly, but it's something to improve the process so as to reduce what I call false positives. And with these are people, those regimes are machines we have to not against in order to make this stuff work in a large community full of contributors to the causes. I realize I'm a little far afield, but I hope it's relevant. And I want to end by pointing out that the folks who spoke today, some of them are very involved in, particularly the creative commons science work, very involved in biological ontologies. And in addition to some of the great open free work that's been mentioned, there are also a number of very strong and in some places dominant classifications in ontologies and taxonomies for diagnostic matters that are, I can only say, somewhat proprietary, strongly defended, and a great deal of arm wrestling about the right as long as it can extract profits from it. the problems which the governing bodies have been struggling with as well. So when you've got somebody who's got something, you're not always immediately able to simply say, we're going to work around them and ignore them if part of your customer or user base are robust users of an established system that's already entrenched. So I'm afraid it's not as easy as we'll just build around it or use something else. I'm sorry, I'm speaking broadly here. So the person who asked the question is welcome to tell me I'm not being responsive, but I'm trying to sort of cover the issue, not just the momentary exposed part of it.
J.D., I'm more worried about the cost of the fight than I am about my potential win.
And if we I agree. And the cost of the fight is primarily an art of the system that is how adjudication is used or created today. You are criticizing the legal regime used to defend and assert claims. I think it's a valid criticism. Personally, I've been speaking on that topic for years, including in audiences of patent lawyers, where that doesn't go over real well. Fixing that is a worthy project, probably somewhat outside of the scope of the OOR project. I'll go further than that. I think we need to talk more about this in the next two meetings. I think even at those next two meetings, we're going to talk about how OOR is designed. You're going to face the temptation to try and fix the legal system, and that's an attractive rat hole that will not contribute much to how to create a project that lives with the uncertainty and risk, which is, I think, our immediate goal. So let me just speak up in favor of the other possible here, in spite of the fact that the larger policy issue is extremely attractive.
Well, John, that's an interesting question in that I think there are some things that this group can do, and there are some things that they can't. For example, I don't believe that a GPL-like effort can and extend it to restrictions on patenting is going to be successful where ontology is concerned. However, we can very clearly, as W3C did, make sure that our own participants are not subpoenaing us.
Good advice from both of you. So, Yuri, I assume you are moderately happy with the responses?
Yeah. Yes, of course. Thank you very much. I try to follow up. Pretty sure I can get.
Okay.
Peter, this is George. I have to sign off for another meeting.
Okay. Thank you very much for spending so much time with us, George.
My pleasure. Very interesting.
Very inspiring, and it's just encouraging to have you with us. Thank you.
Good day.
Bye. I guess we almost have to close anyway. We are already close to 10 minutes over. I will put my hand down because my questions probably can be addressed in the next session. So, Mike, you have you can ask the last question before we wrap up. Mike Bennett, Star 3.
Thanks, Peter. I'll be very quick with this one, for our next discussions, maybe, should you consider a distinction between something, say, for example, the software to develop a thing using Java, which is part of some application, which is designed for a specific purpose, for reasoning, or for some semantic purpose, and because it's an OWL result, you get an ontology, versus a very different kind of thing, which is a record of some reality. And I would suggest that, I mean, that is what an open ontology repository would be for. Would be for ontologies specifically mapping out a domain of interest and not being some kind of design for some purpose. And that perhaps if you separate the questions against those two, some of the questions about patentability may apply to something someone can do without, that may not be relevant to what would be in an ontology, an open ontology repository. So I don't know if that might be helpful in our next conversation.
Before our panelists take your question, Mike, one thing is if we go back onto the Ontology Summit 2008 communique, I would hate to make any scope restrictions on what OOR might be. Of course, if we look at it only as a container, yes. But I remember it was specifically said the most interesting part is for the OOR to provide services. And since this is an open project, that means anyone who wants to provide service will make OOR extremely interesting. And so we don't know, but definitely this would be a question for next two weeks. So Jamie, on that note, Jamie or Bruce, you want to take Mike's comment and take a crack at it?
No. Honestly, Peter, I don't think comments needed at this time because the gentleman's exactly correct. That is part of your problem of collecting the requirements that are peculiar to this proposed project and then deciding what you do and do not need to do. And it's properly the we've been doing giving landscape here. So that more properly relates to the plan for the project in question, which is your next topic.
Fantastic. Okay, so on that note, someone has a hand. Whoever that someone is, could you retype your comment onto the chat board instead of on the hand area? That would be nice. So great. So that's Terry. Totally running out of time. So thank you on behalf of the community. Let us thank our expert panel once again, not only for their great talks, briefings today, but also for staying with us in the next sessions as an advisor. So come join us next week when we will really be looking at what are the issues that will concern us. I mean, as OR or as developers, OR team members, or as ontologists. And among other things, we have, at least on the panel next week, we will have Cameron Ross, who takes a position as one of my co-organizers to throw out a list of issues that we have already identified, and also partly from his position as a developer. We will have John Sower, who, I mean, if you were on the Ontolog forum, would see that he has already raised issues about recent patterns that might sort of be a showstopper for a lot of ontology or biomedical ontology related work, because a certain patent or was awarded without regard to decades of prior art. What can people do about those things? So stay tuned. Yes.
This is Jamie. I will say I'm in China next week, so I'm not entirely sure about the dial-in time for the next session. I will be waiting for the 30th.
All right.
If I have any thoughts, I'll send them to the list.
Exactly.
In the meantime, I just want to say again, you know, the temptation here is to try and solve the bigger problems with the law, and I think that's a good project, and I'm really interested to hear Bruce's take on what a project like this could do. It contributes virtuously to that, but it's also a radically different issue from how to design the project to cope with the current state of things.
Oh, is very good advice. We will keep, we will be reminded of that. And as Jamie just pointed out, we're just starting. So, when I recap our proceedings to the Ontolog Forum today, I will remind everyone that we are opening up a dialogue on the Ontolog Forum mailing list. So let's start fleshing things out on the Ontolog Forum mailing list. And on that note, thanks everyone for joining us. We'll talk to you again next week. Bye bye.
Thank you.
Thank you all.
Peter, thank you for organizing.